Tomorrow, Britain will celebrate women authors with the Women's Prize for Fiction, known until last year as the Orange Prize. It's open to any woman novelist writing in English. This year's shortlist includes some familiar names. Hilary Mantel for her novel Bring Up the Bodies, which already won the prestigious Man Booker Prize. Former Whitbread Award winner Kate Atkinson also makes the cut for her new book Life After Life. And two previous Orange Prize winners, Britain's Zadie Smith, author of N.W., and American Barbara Kingsolver for Flight Behavior. The Dark Horse nominees are also American, A.M. Holmes for her novel May We Be Forgiven, and Maria Semple for Where'd You Go, Bernadette?
And with summer just ahead, time to think about stocking up on entertaining books, award-winning or not. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg has been polling independent booksellers for their suggestions on filling beach bags. She found that two themes popped up on their lists: youth and ritual.
In the book Daily Rituals, How Artists Work, Mason Curry reveals all sorts of strange artistic habits. Everybody has one, says Rona Brindley, owner of the Bookmark in Neptune Beach, Florida.
Yes, and some people like to write in the bathtub, or Truman Capote said he was a horizontal writer. He could only write lying down.
Balanchine thought up choreography by ironing. Stravinsky stood on his head. In Jill McCorkle's novel Life After Life, Sadie invents a ritual to please other residents in her retirement home.
She could cut and paste and put people in any place they wanted to be so people could live their fantasies and do things that they never got to do and go places that they never got to go. And all she needed was, you know, scissors and some glue and a nice background from a Good Southern Living magazine.
Sadie put one resident on a beach and colored her wheelchair red so it looked like a beach chair. She put another near the Taj Mahal. Now, we promised a youth theme for summer reading. How about this pick from Rona Brindley? We will let her pronounce it because I can't.
Okay, it's The Yonelosi Riding Camp for Girls by Anton Di Sclafani.
A first novel set in the Depression, the 15-year-old narrator is sent away to camp.
Because she's done something so horrific, her parents just don't want to look at her anymore. And it's so bad that they leave her there for the rest of the school year. They don't even come back.
Rona Brindley says it's a smart and sexy story about how things happen and the lessons in choices. Lessons, too, in Eleanor Lipman's novel The View from Penthouse B. Two sisters, one widowed, the other divorced, become roommates in the divorcee's fancy New York apartment. She is house poor thanks to a Ponzi scheming cad. The widow invents a business plan.
And it's called Chaste Dates.
Chaste, as in C-H-A-S-T-E, not C-H-A-S-E-D.
And it is for the man or woman who would like to meet somebody to go out with, but is not necessarily looking for a sexual relationship right away. Well, needless to say, this is a tough business plan.
Sparkling writing, Daniel says, funny and sweet.
Who can turn the world on with her smile?
Talk about sparkling, funny, and sweet. The Mary Tyler Moore Show on TV from 1970 to 77, and now in syndication perpetuity, had some of the best writing on television ever.
You know what? You got spunk.
Well, yes.
I hate spunk.
That spunky girl is the subject of the book Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted, a compilation by Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong of oral histories from folks who worked on the show. Daniel Golden learned that at first audiences didn't like Mary's best friend and neighbor, Rhoda Morgenstern.
She was a brash New Yorker. She spoke her mind. She started out arguing.
The writers added a simple line to the script for a cute little girl.
Mary's landlord, Phyllis, had a daughter named Beth, and they decided to just, as an aside, have Beth say to Mary, "That's Rhoda, I really like her." And that totally changed how the audience felt about her.
Minneapolis, the setting for the Mary Tyler Moore Show, was pretty foreign to a New Yorker like Rhoda, but nothing like the exoticism of Los Angeles to the hero of Pacific by Tom Drury. Lucia Silva, book buyer for the late lamented Portrait of a Bookstore in Studio City, California, says Drury's 14-year-old protagonist grew up in a tiny Midwestern town. He goes west to live with his mother and falls in with a wild group of L.A. teens. Lucia Silva says Drury's not a native Angeleno, but he writes like one.
I'm born and raised in Los Angeles, and those of us who are know that L.A. is really this sprawling mecca that is secretly a small, quirky town.
A father and mother flee a small Chinese village in The Dark Road by Ma Jian. They leave with their two-year-old when the government enforces its one-child policy.
Meili is pregnant with the second child, and they leave the village and live in this disintegrating houseboat traveling down the Yangtze River.
Their fugitive life is based on actual experiences, horrifying and compelling reading. Finally, Poems to Learn by Heart, edited by Caroline Kennedy.
If I could choose one book to give to, you know, every family in the country for the summer read, this would be it.
A nice family project, Lucia thinks, reading together a range of poems from Shakespeare to Billy Collins and then memorizing a few.
This sort of is a return to the idea of learning by heart. You know, we don't say we learn it by brain or by mind.
By heart, you can give a poem away, share it, but it never leaves you. Here's one.
Ballad of the Morning Streets by Amiri Baraka. The magic of the day is the morning. I want to say the day is morning, high and sweet, good morning. The ballad of the morning streets, sweet voices, turns of cool, warm weather, high around the early windows, gray to blue, and down again amongst the kids and broken signs, is pure love magic. Sweet day, come into me. Let me live with you and dig your blazing.
Good morning, and thanks to all our independent booksellers for their summer reading ideas. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
We have those and other reading suggestions for you at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Historian Mary Louise Roberts says she's written a book that can make our memories of the Second World War, the good war, as we often think of it, more truthful and more complex. Her book is called What Soldiers Do: Sex and the American GI in World War II France. It's a story of relations between American men and French women in Normandy and elsewhere. The Americans were liberators, the French were liberated, but sex created tensions and resentments that were serious and were utterly absent from contemporary accounts for American audiences back home.
With the streets cleared, the victors formally enter the city. Everyone gathers for a joyful liberation celebration. Yanks and French join in the celebration. Here's a French Betsy Ross. The children have made American flags from paper, coloring them with watercolors. They've learned a song to honor our boys.
Mary Louise Roberts, who's professor of European history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
To the program. And to put it mildly, it wasn't entirely grateful Normans and respectful GIs in liberated Normandy.
I think it's a matter of chronology. I think that initially the Normans were incredibly grateful to be liberated. They had also suffered a lot of loss that summer. So there was some anger about the destruction of their homes and the loss of their loved ones. But in general, at least at the beginning, the French were very happy to be liberated and to greet the Americans.
Then you report complaints by, say, the mayor of Havre, who's complaining about American GIs having sex in public with French prostitutes, so much so that a family can't take children out for a walk anymore.
Yes, that happened in the summer of 1945, so a year later. Le Havre was a port, really the entry and exit port for millions of American soldiers during those years. Those soldiers who had been fighting in France and Germany came back to Le Havre waiting for a boat home. They were, as a group, exhausted and traumatized. Their lost friends crowded their dreams. They were consumed by guilt. So they took to whoring with French women as a way to keep away the demons, at least for a while. And without a proper or regulated system of brothels, they instead took to the streets, abandoned buildings, parks, and cemeteries, having sex.
Your title, What Soldiers Do, implies that hundreds of thousands of men far from home flirting with death have sex with prostitutes. But you also write, sex was fundamental to how the U.S. military framed, fought, and won the war in Europe. Which was it, the behavior of the universal soldier or something unique to that army in that place?
It was a particularly eroticized war. Anybody who remembers the pinups on airplanes, Rita Hayworth, the amount to which pinups became a part of the culture of the GIs, will recognize to what extent sex became important to the war experience. I went and looked at Stars and Stripes, which is the trench journal. And what I saw there was an extension of the pinup culture. Photojournalism in particular was used to portray the French woman as ready to be rescued, ready to greet the American soldier, and ready to congratulate and thank him through a kiss or even more.
And as the Americans were multiplying in force in Normandy, young French women came from all over the country to prostitute themselves.
Yes, that's true. I would have to say that prostitution was pervasive in the European theater. There was one army report that estimated 80% of single men and 50% of married men would have sex during their stay in Europe. And the U.S. military did not really care that much that it occurred. What it cared about was venereal disease, mm-hmm. which soon after the GI's arrivals in France began to soar to unacceptable levels. But all this was kept from the American public.
The other issue you address is rape. In the summer of 1944, mm-hmm. you write, there was in Normandy a wave of rape accusations by French women against American soldiers. And the U.S. Army's response, as you recounted, was to frame it essentially as a race problem. I want you to describe what happened.
What happened was the American Army and the juridical system attached to the Army, the JAG office, disproportionately blamed African-American soldiers. 77% of the court-martial prosecutions in the European theater were for African-Americans. They were only 10% of the troops.
We're talking, though, about trials that would take place almost instantly after an accusation.
Yes, sometimes 3 days afterwards.
And then there were quite a few summary executions by hanging.
That's right. Many of the men were hung in the towns where the alleged rape occurred. And the hanging was a difficult thing to do in the land of the guillotine. So the U.S. Army actually brought in their own hangman from Texas. I found a file in the National Archives which dealt with this.
Yes, he came with his ropes from...
He came from, with his rope, yes.
From over the
grisly,
seas.
Very grisly.
I mean, what you've done here is you've described the liberation of France, not from the perspective we're accustomed to seeing it told from. This is from the perspective of the French.
Yes.
And a very female perspective as well of what's going on. And the war comes out a lot more nuanced in terms of its virtues after we read your book. How do you as a historian integrate your sense of this heroic crossing of the English Channel, one of the most greatest military exercises in human history, and the perhaps inevitable behavior of the troops once they were in France?
Well, I guess like many people, I was somewhat surprised when I found out that the GIs were not impeccable soldiers. I began to look at documents in France that were only opened in January of 2005, and in many cases, I was the first American to look at them. I grew up in a very patriotic family. My father is a veteran of the Second World War. So all this was difficult for me. But I actually also have to say that there's nothing in my book that tries to condemn or mm-hmm. denigrate that great moment. What I'm trying to do is give a fuller picture by looking at how the event was seen by the French to make it richer and more complex. And to me, really good history portrays an event not in a sanitized way, but as a way in which you can allow yourself to think of soldiers as human beings.
Lou Roberts, Mary Louise Roberts, thanks a lot for talking with us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Professor Roberts' book is called What Soldiers Do, Sex and the American GI in World War II France.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The writer Colm McCann was born and raised in Ireland and now lives in the United States. When he decided to write a book that explores the ties that bind Ireland with the U.S., he wanted to stay far away from the usual clichés about what it means to be Irish-American. The result is Transatlantic. It's a fictional account of key events in the lives of some historic figures who traveled to Ireland in search of freedom, adventure, and peace. NPR's Lynn Neary tells us more.
About 5 years ago, Colm McCann stumbled upon a small piece of history he had never known. In 1845, Frederick Douglass, then an escaped slave who was already famous for his anti-slavery writings and speeches, visited Ireland to raise money and support for his cause. McCann knew almost immediately that he wanted to turn this historic fact into fiction.
This intersection between history and fiction, between what is real and what is not real, fascinates me.
Facts can deceive, says McCann, whereas fiction often gets closer to the truth.
It's interesting how the truth gets perceived and how the repeated lie becomes the truth. And this is a place for a fiction writer to sort of dwell. So I tried to braid together what we would call history and what we would call fiction. And one seems to me to be as true as the other.
Douglas's visit to Ireland may have been the catalyst for the novel, but McCann begins the book with another little-known historic event that happened years later, just after World War I, the first nonstop transatlantic flight. Before Charles Lindbergh made his famous solo journey, two young Brits, Jack Alcock and Teddy Brown, flew from Newfoundland to Ireland, landing unceremoniously in a bog.
The smell of the earth, so astoundingly fresh, it strikes Brown like a thing he might eat. His ears throb. His body feels as if it is moving through the air. He is, he thinks, the first man ever to fly and stand at the exact same time. The war out of the machine. He holds the small bag of letters up in salute. On they come. Soldiers, people, the light drizzle of grey. Ireland, a beautiful country. A bit savage on a man all the same. Ireland.
McCann brings his story into contemporary times with his depiction of Senator George Mitchell's role in the Northern Ireland peace process. At first, there seems to be no connection between McCann's fictional accounts of these disparate events.
I wanted to bring the novel entirely up to date, so it spans about 150 years from the arrival of Douglas all the way up to the peace process with Mitchell. And to be totally honest, I didn't know at first what the connection was. I was completely corralled by the idea of Douglas being in Ireland. And I knew at some stage that I wanted to write about the peace process.
McCann found his link in the humble form of an Irish maid named Lily, who waits on Douglas during his stay in Dublin. It is an encounter which changes her life entirely.
The thing about it is that she looks at this man and he's different and he's beautiful and he's brilliant and he represents some sort of freedom for her. And it's grandly ironic that a young woman can look at an American slave in Ireland and he represents freedom. And then she goes across to achieve her own particular type of freedom in the United States.
Lily and her descendants, her daughter and granddaughter, cross paths only briefly with these historic figures. But as they do, their lives become entwined with events that made history.
Women have been given a great role in fiction, but often they have been denied access to the grand narrative of historical events that they've always been a part of. And I knew that while I was writing these narratives of these great men, that I also had to do a corresponding narrative of women and talk about their power and how their stories braided together and actually became more important to the novel and to the telling of the story than the story of the men.
History, says McCann, does not take place in a vacuum. It belongs to everyone.
One of the things that I truly want to say is that all of our stories matter, no matter who we happen to be, no matter where we happen to be, no matter how supposedly anonymous our actions are. We enter the grand historical narrative at an angle and we affect history.
The Irish are known as a people who have been forced, often by hunger and poverty, to leave their country. But McCann's novel makes it clear the traffic across has gone both ways, and that people on both sides of the Atlantic owe a great deal to each other. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This summertime novelty tune has been pouring out of radios now for 50 years.
Hello, mother. Hello, father. Here I am at Camp Granada. Camp is very entertaining. And they say we'll have some fun if it stops raining.
In late July of 1963, Billboard magazine reported that fans were, and I quote, actually breaking down doors, unquote, of record stores to buy the song about the pains of summer camp. The man behind this sensation was a short, plump guy with a crew cut, big glasses, and a surprisingly small nose. He'd had it fixed. Alan Sherman had been a TV producer who'd entertained his friends with song parodies for years. He then collected them on an LP called My Son, the Folk Singer. Old favorites were rewritten with a contemporary suburban Jewish audience in mind. It was never expected to appeal to the general public.
I'm upside down, my head is turning around because I gotta sell the house in Levittown. Oh, salesmen come and salesmen go, and my best one is gone, I know. And if he don't come back to me, I'll have to close the factory. But give me Jack Cone and I don't care.
Oh, to everyone's surprise, by August of 1963, three Sherman albums were on Billboard's Top 100 chart. Mark Cohen has written a book about the short-lived success of the musical satirist. It's called, somewhat cruelly, Overweight Sensation, The Life and Comedy of Alan Sherman. And Mark Cohen joins us from New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Alan Sherman was funny, and at the time he was a very big success, but an almost scholarly book about him? I mean, what can we learn from this man's story?
Well, I think Sherman was a very interesting pop culture figure at a moment when ethnic identity was first blossoming in America in the post-war period. We had had a long period of Americanization. And Sherman appeared just at the moment when that was beginning to end.
And it's a real moment, certainly in the life of the American Jewish community. Not just pop culture. Leonard Bernstein, the novelist Saul Bellow, and Philip Roth. It was a more frank depiction of what it was to be Jewish in America, and often a funny depiction.
Right. And that was one of Sherman's big themes, was trying to own some of the Jewish cultural products that Jews offered to America without, as I jokingly say, asking for a receipt.
I remember the Alan Sherman days, and this is part of my favorite Alan Sherman song called Shake Hands with Your Uncle Max.
Shake hands with your Uncle Max, my boy, and here is your sister Cheryl, and here is your cousin Isabel, that's Irving's oldest girl. And you remember the Tishman twins, Gerald and Jerome. We all came out to greet you and to wish you welcome home. Meet Merowitz, Barowitz, Handelman, Shandelman, Sperber and Gerber and Steiner and Stone. Moskowitz, Lupowitz, Aronson, Behrens, Kleiman and Feynman and Friedman and Cohn. Smolowitz, Wallowitz.
You know, the problem for people who were not of a certain age is they don't know the Irish tune that this was satirizing.
That's true, but I also remember hearing this song before I understood that it was a parody of an earlier Irish tune. That didn't diminish my enjoyment of the song, but once I did learn it, it became even more brilliant.
The story of Alan Sherman, apart from his great success, he'd already been successful as a television producer. When he became a huge success, this is the classic, did success ruin Alan Sherman? The answer is absolutely, totally, fatally. He had a heart attack at a fairly early age.
He died before he turned 49. But, of course, the year of extraordinary fame that he enjoyed when his three My Son albums all went gold, made his life a success for him at any rate before things went fatally wrong.
So what went wrong?
Well, where do I begin? Sherman was an extraordinarily hungry man for all sorts of experiences. And that included drink, lots of food, lots of women, lots of gambling. I'm forgetting all the vices because he covered them all.
Here's the great irony, or perhaps it's more predictable than that, about Alan Sherman, which is he ends up becoming this guy who makes jokes about being Jewish in America in the 1960s. In his own family, his parents were terrible to him, ran from their Jewishness. He was ultimately raised by his much more happily Jewish grandparents.
He was born as Alan Coplin, and his mother, her maiden name was Rose Sherman. His father was Percy Coplin. His mother raised in Chicago. His father raised in Birmingham, Alabama. They were very unstable people who were really not capable of raising a child. And so his mother had to send him to her parents. And in his grandparents' home, he discovered the world that his mother left behind. And he decided, this is what I want in life.
In my very small sample of people under 40 that I've checked, Alan Sherman's humor is not all that accessible. And you have to transport yourself back to 1963. For example, this parody, which has, I think, one of his funniest lines ever written.
I'm singing you the ballad of a great man of the cloth. His name was Harry Lewis, and he worked for Irving Roth.
You have to assume that Jews in New York are deeply involved in employment in the garment industry. Cutting, sewing, selling, that this is what employed the better part of a huge Jewish community.
Oh, Harry Lewis perished in the service of his Lord. He was trampling through the warehouse where the drapes of Roth are stored.
He worked awfully hard for that joke.
That was a pretty darn good pun.
There are people from those days, like Mel Brooks, who went on, who survived, who became bigger than they were in the early 1960s. Alan Sherman, I don't know that, you know, that people remember him or know that much about him these days.
No, that's very true. Sherman was much more greatly damaged. I often think about that wonderful little poem I discovered that he wrote when he was in junior high school. Humpty Dumpty sat on a train, happily singing, Bemir Bistushain. He was a damaged, fragile Humpty Dumpty who could be made happy by singing Jewish-oriented songs.
Harvey and Sheila Harvey and Sheila Harvey and Sheila moved to West L.A.
He said the Christian name of this song is Hava Nagila. He felt Harvey and Sheila was really closer to the truth about American Jewish life than Hava Nagila itself.
Mark Cohn, author of Overweight Sensation, The Life and Comedy of Alan Sherman, thank you very much for talking with us about him today.
Robert, thank you very much for having me.
Oh, that Harvey, he was really smart. He used his noodle. Sheila bought a white French poodle. Went to Europe with a visa. Harvey's rich. They say that he's a VIP. This could be only in the USA.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Wade Goodwin. When Cherie Booker was 15 years old, she took on a most unusual job for a teenager. She went to work in a Baltimore funeral home. She has written about her time working that job in the book 9 Years Under. The result is a witty, irreverent coming-of-age memoir unlike any other. Cherie Booker, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Early in the book, you write about your Aunt Mary, who I guess had been very important to you, and she became ill, and you write on page 2, after weeks of hospice care and enough meds to tranquilize an army, Aunt Mary slipped through our fingers like $20,000 on a gambler's bad day. No little girl wants to stand by and witness her hero surrender. I wish someone had told me back then that hospice care was the beginning of the end. Then I wouldn't have blamed myself for not doing enough. I wouldn't have felt ignored by God. Was Aunt Mary an inspiration for this book?
She certainly was. My Aunt Mary she was like a grandmother to me. She is the reason I am spoiled to this day. She was always there. She was my father's great aunt, and she was my great great aunt. And she lived with us from the time I was born until she passed away when I was 15 years old. She was my everything.
Her death led you to Wiley's funeral home.
Absolutely. If my Aunt Mary had not passed away, there is no way I would have ended up working in a funeral home. But after Aunt Mary died, I felt like I needed closure. And so while most people run away from death, I ran towards it. I wanted answers. I wanted to make sure that she was in good hands. So I found a way into the funeral home. And it was only supposed to be a summer, and it ended up being 9 years.
And you take us inside that world. And in a way, it was the beginning of your education. Talk to me a little bit about your neighborhood. And your parents, your father was a police officer. Mm-hmm. Your mother was a school principal. They kept mm-hmm. you pretty protected from the Baltimore neighborhood that was all around you.
Yes. Growing up, I was kind of like a bookworm. And so I was pretty naive and green to certain things. Whereas the funeral home was in a totally different neighborhood in West Baltimore, things that I had never seen growing up, actually.
One of the things I learned from your book is that working at a funeral home is kind of like being on stage, that death lends each day a certain gravitas. Mm-hmm. Was each showing a little bit like a performance piece for you?
I don't know if I would call it a performance piece, but I dealt with grieving families. So I had to be in a different frame of mind to be able to deal with those families who were grieving and a lot of emotions. But the rule was that I wasn't allowed to cry or be emotional, regardless of what I saw on a day-to-day basis. So if it was a baby, if it was a homicide, if there was someone who died naturally, a cute little old lady, I wasn't allowed to cry. One of the things I will say that I, when I first started working there, I would cry every time I saw someone in there. As soon as I saw someone else cry, I'm like, oh, my God, I can't believe it. Why? And then my boss just came to me one day and he's like, no, you cannot do this. Look at the wall. Look at the floor. Do something. But you cannot cry in my funeral home. It gave me tougher skin and it made me take my job a lot more seriously.
Albert P. Wiley is a important, if not the most important character in the mm-hmm. book, and I think someone who was important to you.
Absolutely.
Early on, you described him as a hustler. What was it about Wiley that made him such a good funeral home director?
He treated every case like it was his own loved one, and that's what he taught us to do. He had a reputation and people admired him and they looked up to him because he's that person that when you drive through the neighborhood and you wave your hand up, he's going to holler back at you. Hey, how you doing? And, you know, he's that familiar face. Not to mention that he had great swagger and a great personality. He had a great he drove a Cadillac and, you know, he's just there. He's visible.
He had a reputation.
Yeah.
A good one. As the years go by, you begin to learn about just how rough things are out there in the poor black community that surrounds Wiley Funeral Home. Mm-hmm. And it moves you to start writing poetry, and you wrote a poem called Endangered Black Man. I mm-hmm. wonder if you would read that poem to us.
Confined to the streets, oppressed, you will never be free, free from your own bondage. Incarcerated not only by physical means, but black man, you are mentally bound to your cage and you're still not enraged. You just don't get it. Endangered black man, you have destroyed me, the voice of the black tomorrow. And now all our people see is sorrow. And no cries of empathy do we ever hear. Never have they shed a tear, but because of you, I live in fear. Endangered black man.
That's there's a lot of emotion in that poem. Anger and sorrow and fear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, we did see cases of retaliation, and we actually had a shootout at the funeral home one day when I was there. A young man was on view, and all of a sudden you just heard all of this chaos and people are running up the stairs and just banging. And come to find out, there was a drive-by right outside of the funeral home. Someone was trying to shoot this young man's brother.
Let's talk about the embalming room in the basement. You talk about it at first like it's Frankenstein's laboratory, and you're terrified to set foot down there. But over time, you grow into the embalming room yourself. Tell us that story.
Okay, so here was the deal. I started working there when I was 15. My parents really didn't mind, but the one rule that my father set was, whatever you do, do not go in the basement where they do the embalming. But one day, Mr. Wally called me down in the basement, and I was terrified. I crept down the steps, and I'm like, oh my God, heart is beating, racing. I'm starting to feel nauseous. I don't know what I'm going to see. And then he asked me to come in the next room and wipe down a casket. And Mr. Wally is in that room embalming. And I'm like, oh my God, what have I walked into? Once I realized I could stomach it, I became more curious. And so I just walked over and started asking him a lot of questions. And he basically walked me through the process from where he was. And in that particular day, it was actually a suicide case of a young male. And I will never forget that day because he had inscribed his suicide letter on his arm and it said, I want Peanut to cut my hair and I want my eyes open. And I just will never, ever forget those words for the rest of my life.
But Peanut did not cut his hair and his eyes were not left open, were they?
No,
which speaks to another issue, which is, you know, despite the wishes of the dead, once they are dead, the wishes of the living often take precedence.
I always say, you know, death is not about the person who passed away. It's always about the person who's still left here.
You're now a writer and a teacher, but it's always good to have a trade. Do you think you're done with the funeral home business or might you go back?
My ultimate goal is to own my own funeral home one day. I would like to get back in the business. I enjoyed servicing families and being there to be their support system. I do not want to embalm every day, but I know the business. It's something that I know very well, and I would definitely like to get back in it.
And so would you recommend to your young daughter at age 15, you know, you should work in a funeral home?
Absolutely not. Now, if I do go into the funeral business, then it will certainly be a family business, so she'll be around it. But if not, then no, I wouldn't recommend it to my daughter.
How come, giving all that you learned and what a wonderful experience it turned out to be for you, why not? Shouldn't every American spend some time working at a funeral home?
You know, I was ready to face death at that point in my life, and I can't say that the next American or the next person would be able to handle something as great as that and the responsibility that it has.
Cherie Booker is the author of 9 Years Under, a coming-of-age memoir of her time working in a Baltimore funeral home. Cherie, thanks so much.
Thank you.